Seastate with Rhonda Moniz is a production of the Technology Systems Corporation and the Underwater Investigative Group. For more information, visit oceannews.com and theuigroup.net. Support for today's episode of Seastate with Rhonda Moniz comes from Klein Marine Systems. Founded in 1968, Klein Marine Systems, a wholly owned subsidiary of Mitchum Industries Incorporated, is the world's leading supplier of side-scan sonar equipment, waterside security, and surveillance systems. Hello and welcome to Seastate, the podcast for all your ocean technology news. My name is Rhonda Moniz and I will be your host as we chat with all the movers and shakers in the marine technology industry. We will keep you informed, involved, and immersed. So stay tuned and stay up to date on Seastate. So before we start today's episode, I'd like to ask you a question. Have you ever used side-scan sonar? Possibly to do a survey, maybe to locate a shipwreck? Well, if you have used this technology, then you have my next guest to thank for that, the pioneer of side-scan sonar, Mr. Marty Klein. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Rhonda. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent. So I just want to thank you for being a part of our show today, and I have to ask you, how are your bonsai trees?
My bonsai are great. I've actually been able to start to work on them, and they've just come out of storage for the year. And finally, today's a nice day. After we're done, I'm going to go repot some trees and wire some things. So, yeah, they're good.
Oh, that sounds very zen. So let's start out with chatting about the beginnings of your career and how you got involved in the development of side-scan sonar.
Yes, I'll be glad to, Rhonda, and it's a pleasure to be here meeting with you. I kind of started in the field by accident. I'm an old, I like to build things. People joke about that I was born with a pocket knife, and all my life I've liked to do practical things. And I went to MIT. I was an electrical engineering student. And in my senior year, we had to do a thesis, and I needed a topic. And I had some topics that were kind of very theoretical. They involved a lot of math, and I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to create something, build something. And kind of by a wonderful chance of fate, I went to the office of a Professor Harold Edgerton. His lab was on the fourth floor of the main building at MIT. And he was a very famous guy. He's known for the development of the strobe light. And I went into his office and said, gee, might you have anything interesting to work on? And my life to this day has never been the same. He introduced me to the underwater world. It turns out that he was friends with Jacques Cousteau, the famous ocean explorer.
Wow.
Edgerton and Cousteau were introduced to each other by the National Geographic magazine. Cousteau wanted to take pictures in the deepest part of the ocean. And Edgerton was the world's expert in strobes and cameras. And so he and Sam Raymond, who was the founder of Ventos, he made some special cameras and strobes for Cousteau. And they went out and, in fact, took pictures in the first ever pictures in the deep ocean. And you know what? The camera was just lowered on a line, not an electrical line. There was no electrical connection. And in order to position the camera above the bottom, cameras can't see that far in the ocean. So you have to get pretty near the bottom and take a picture. So they put a pinger, a precision timed echo sounder, on the camera apparatus. And that thing, that's what they used to position the camera. The pinger would send out a ping to the ocean floor, and it also off its back, it would send out another ping. And then up on the ship, they had a graphic recorder that could see those two pings. And as they got close together and the camera was within, say, 10 feet of the bottom, the camera would be triggered, and they took these first photos.
Wow.
And Doc was this amazing scientist, amazing human being. He noticed that on the traces of this pinger, he was getting a little bit of penetration of the bottom sediments. And he took a fascination with the subject, and he began to develop a device he called the mud penetrator that would be used to look at the shallow sediments in the ocean floor.
Sort of like a precursor to the sub-bottom profiler, right?
Well, it is. And there were, existed at the time, there were echo sounders, there were sub-bottom profilers that were used in oil work, but this was a very specific application to look a very shallow sub-bottom profile. And by a weird quirk of fate, I walked into this scene, and as a kid, I had been fascinated with these new devices called transistors. They were developed in the 50s by guys from Bell Labs, Bardeen, Bertain, I forget the three names. And I had as a kid, I read about them, and I developed a fascination for them, and I used them. I could take my whole allowance and buy one transistor. And I built little radios, and I took every radio in the house apart and made it into an intercom. And I had a little bit of a background.
Your parents must have loved that, right?
yeah. Well, I was very lucky. I had very supportive parents. And I had learned about electronics. My father had actually taken me when I was a kid. In New York City, there was an area called Radio Row, and there were a whole bunch of stores that sold old radio equipment. Some of it was from the Second World War. Some of it was just surplus equipment of various types. And he took me to a store called Leotone, and he bought me a crystal set.
Hmm.
And there were two versions of the crystal set. One was a kit, and one was all built. And so we only had so much money, and I think it was $1.25, I'm not sure. But I built this kit. I built this crystal set, and I could receive WCBS radio in New York City. And so I had a fascination for all this stuff when I got to MIT. And in those days, the world, most things in the world ran on vacuum tubes, what they call valves in England. They were these glass things with filaments in them. And Doc's equipment, in fact, ran on vacuum tubes. And so he asked me to work on it. He didn't tell me specifically what to do, but I became kind of obsessed with improving Doc's equipment. And working with him was just the most amazing thing. He was literally one of the world's great scientists. He had figured out in World War II, he and his team had to photograph an atomic bomb.
Wow.
And those pictures that you see of atomic bombs that we all grew up with, these big things, it was Doc who, it turns out, to photograph an atomic bomb, it's extremely bright, it's extremely fast, and it's extremely unpredictable. And so it was quite a feat to take those pictures. And so Doc actually had a company called Edgerton, Germershausen, and Greer. It was him and two of his colleagues formed this company. So anyway, I worked in Doc's lab, and famous people would stop in there. I met Jacques Cousteau. I met Edward Land, the founder of Polaroid. Doc knew everybody. He knew the president of the United States. But he was also incredibly down to earth, and he was an incredible warm person. He was proud. He was from Nebraska, and he was the kindest person. And he treated me like family. And one of the things he did one day, he gave me a key to his laboratory, which was just became my most prized possession. In those days, I was a student, and I would work weird hours. I'd work in the middle of the night, and so I could go myself and go open up the lab. And it's funny how this is a long time ago. He actually had a rifle in the lab where we would take pictures of bullets going through cards and balloons and things like that. You can't imagine nowadays having a rifle in the
lab. Oh, I know. Things are so different. I think I've seen those pictures, yeah.
But so anyway, I got immersed in the world of Edgerton. I learned about high-speed photography. He had a wonderful dark room in his place. And he would take us students out on I call them experiences. We would go out and put strobe lights in different places. We would just do all kinds of things, all kind of electronic stuff. So I worked on his devices. So this mud penetrator he made, it would look at the bottom, but the traces on it were lousy. They were fuzzy. And there was a lot of noise and a lot of ringing. And I'm kind of a pain in the neck. I like to improve things. It's kind of a mantra of mine. In any situation, if you can come in and make it better, it's something I talk to the students about all the time. And so I wanted to make it better, and I was kind of obsessed with making it better. And so I would fiddle with the circuits, and I'd have my soldering iron and Doc had, he had some, what was for that day was modern oscilloscopes and modern technology. And I would fiddle and build it and fiddle. And in the lab, the sonar was pointed at the wall. And you would take a plywood sheet and just walk it back and forth in front of the sonar. And on the graphic recorder, you would see traces of this target. And as I say, they were fuzzy, and I was just unhappy with them. And then, so one day in the middle of the night, I just did whatever I did, the right fiddling, and the signals became very clean. They looked like a fine pencil line. They were dramatically better than we had ever seen. And I was all excited, and in fact, I took the record, and I laid it on Doc's desk, in which was adjoining his lab. And I wrote something like, I used to know some French. I wrote something like, Il marche, it works, with a big exclamation point. And Doc saw it, and he loved it. So I wound up working with Doc, becoming a protege, a student of his, a protege of his. And I worked in his lab for about 6 months right at MIT. And then in this company, Edgerton, Germershausen, and Greer, although their main focus was working for the Atomic Energy Commission, there was a little tiny oceanographic department, and they built Doc's gadgets. He made various sub-bottom profilers. He made boomers. He made underwater cameras and strobes. He made a variety of things in this little department. And so I went to work as a junior engineer at this company. It was a big company. At the time, we worked in a number of places in Boston. One was next to the original Radio Shack on Commonwealth Avenue across from Boston University. And we actually worked in an old car repair shop where they had these concrete pits in the ground where they would service automobiles. And we had that full of water. We used it as a test tank to test our underwater devices.
Wow.
And we also worked at times on Brookline Avenue. And in fact, one of the buildings we worked was literally across from Fenway Park at 100 Brookline Avenue. And it's kind of a funny side story, but I grew up in New York City, and I was a big fan of the New York Giants. And I was a fanatic fan. And one day, so my family were either Yankee fans or Dodger fans, and I was a Giant fan. And they took them away. They went to San Francisco. They took my team away, and I was devastated. And for years, I never watched baseball. And so here I was, literally working across the street from Fenway Park, and never went to a game. I did years later. I finally got sucked into it, but it's kind of ironic because I still, to this day, go by that building where I used to work on Brookline Avenue.
That is funny.
So at EG&G, it later became called EG&G, I worked on various devices. I worked on underwater cameras. I worked on boomers. We had a test tank in the building we called a pickle barrel. It was a big thing underwater where we tested equipment. And one of the things I learned from Doc is about testing, that you have to really, when you're putting stuff in the ocean, it's it's a big deal. It's hard making things to work underwater, making them get shipped around the world and have to work. They have to be rugged. You have to know how to fix them. They have to be serviceable. They have to, you have to carry spare parts with you if you need them. So I learned of that, and we would go to sea. I would go to, sometimes Doc had a little Boston Whaler on the Charles River in Boston, and I would go out with him. Sometimes he'd wake me up on a Sunday morning at 5 a.m. and say, hey, Klein, get out of bed. We're going to go look and see if the tunnels are still under Boston Harbor. And if the old man said go, you would go. So we would go on trips together and find things. And one of the fun things in that is we once went to look for a tugboat in Boston Harbor, and we went out on this guy who had lost it in another boat, and we saw a trace on the sonar, and we threw a buoy down, and the buoy hit a gas bottle on the boat.
Ooh.
And this gas bottle came up to the, it didn't explode, but it was just a float. It floated to the surface and started chugging around on the ocean floor. And the owner of the boat was flabbergasted that we could do that. And Doc and I, we used to share a lot of humor with each other. And so we winked at each other and we told them we usually aim for the nameplate of a boat, but this time we just got the water bottle. And so I went on and got into this world, and it involved traveling and involved a lot of things. But one day I had just started my career, and we got news that the submarine Thresher had sunk off the coast of Boston in deep water. And it was stunning. My cousin was a naval architect, and I knew he worked on submarines, but it was just stunning. Everyone was killed, and it was in deep water. And I suddenly got thrust in the middle of the Thresher search, which was the first deep search ever made underwater. And here I am, I'm a young kid, I'm just out of school. And I was assigned the Bathyscaphe Trieste a few years earlier in 1960 had made the famous dive to 7 miles down in the ocean. And the Trieste was called into service to help with the Thresher search. It was based at that time in San Diego. It was owned by the Navy. And it was brought to Boston for the Thresher search. And I was assigned to install a sonar, a side scan sonar, on the Bathyscaphe. And this thing looked out to the side. It also looked straight up. It also looked straight down. And it even had a pinger navigation, a long baseline navigation system. Very sophisticated thing. And so we practically, at the beginning, we worked 24 hours a day. I moved the cot into the company, and we developed this stuff. I did have a lot of help, but we developed this stuff. So I would commute between San Diego and Boston. And I got to know the Trieste crew, and I got to go down the ladder and into the hatch of this submersible. And it was an incredible experience. This is, you know, we're really pioneering, where I didn't appreciate that much just how much we were doing. But so we made this sonar, and the sonar, I mentioned that Doc had this had used an echo sounder for his work. At some point in the lab, we were pointing it sideways. It started out pointing downward, but at some point he tilted it sideways so it would look out across the ocean floor, and it could see things on the sea floor. And it made a picture. It was not a good picture. It was it had a conical beam. It didn't really have the right beam or frequency, but it did find things on occasion. But it, much to my dismay, we failed to find the Thresher. The Thresher was found with a magnetometer, and that's a whole long story. It was found and photographed, and but I was very dismayed. I wasn't happy with the sonar that we had made. And so I became obsessed with making something better, making something that would really make, where the sonar would, pictures would really look like pictures, where a shipwreck would look like a shipwreck, and a log would look like a log, and a pier would look like a pier, and so forth. And So here I am working at this little company, not a lot of funds, but a lot of determination. And it's a lengthy story, but we did it. I was lucky to have some superb technicians to work with. I was lucky to have some mentors. One of them was Sam Raymond. By that time, he had founded Bentos. One of them was Ed Curley, who was the founder. He left EG&G and formed a company called EPC Labs. And a number of other people helped me out, and including Doc. And so we finally made a sonar that could really make pictures. And it was a revelation. And we would go out and we'd actually, we found aircraft, we found shipwrecks. And at first I made a single channel one that just looked in one direction, but then I made a two channel one. And the single channel one we introduced in 1966, but in 1967, I was ready to introduce this EG&G side scan sonar. Now, I learned a lot later that side scan sonar did exist. The military had built side scan sonars in the 50s. The Navy and people in England had built a thing called a shadow graph, which had very high resolution. It was extremely expensive, but it worked at a very high frequency and had a very sophisticated jellyfish. I learned about all this stuff kind of later. So these things were millions of dollars. They were extremely complicated, extremely difficult to operate. So what I made was one that was relatively affordable, that was could be introduced in the commercial world. And we were ready in 1967, we were actually ready to introduce it to the world. We were going to go to a convention of the Marine Technology Society in San Diego. And I'm still just a young punk engineer. And it's a small company, but small companies have their quirks and their bureaucracies. It became part of the culture that engineers weren't good at sales and weren't too socially adept or whatever. I was told you can't go, and here I am. I've just finished this thing, and I want to show it to the world. But I was told you're just an engineer. You can't go, and I was flabbergasted. So I actually bought myself a plane ticket, and I went to. It was in San Diego, this MTS show in San Diego, and I went to the booth, and we introduced this thing to the world. And I still actually have some pictures of me in the booth showing this thing. I had a little more hair in those days. It was an amazing success right from the start. It became very popular. A number of things happened. Doc became, he wasn't all that supportive when I was first building it, but once it was built, he just fell in love with it and adopted it. And he went to England to work with a guy named Alex McGee, who was looking for a ship called the Mary Rose. The Mary Rose was the flagship of Henry VIII. And Doc went with a guy named Robert Henderson from EG&G, and they worked with McGee, and they brought this mud penetrator, the Pinger, and the new side scan sonar. And they, in fact, found the Mary Rose, and it's one of the great underwater finds ever made. The Mary Rose, it became a very famous thing. It was actually raised, and Prince Charles was involved diving on it, and it was brought to a museum in Portsmouth, where it actually has been restored over the years. And it's an incredible project because it was many artifacts, and it for years they soaked it in polyethylene glycol, and so they've done all kind of restoration. So it's in a museum. And I went off with a man named George Bass, who is one of the pioneers in marine archaeology.
Oh yeah, everyone knows George Bass.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I went to Turkey with the sonar. George was looking for an ancient ship off the coast of Bodrum, Turkey. And I went with the sonar, and George had this amazing operation on an island called Yasiata, just off the coast of Bodrum, Turkey. And I brought the sonar, and there were other sonars in the world that had been built in research labs, and one of them was at Scripps. They had actually built a sonar, a guy named Maurice McGehee and Tony Bogeman, and they had used the sonar there, and they had picked up some possible targets. And then I started operating my sonar, and Don Rosenkrantz was navigating the boat. In those days, no GPS, so we navigated the ship using, we had transits and theodolites on the shore, and we were near shore, so you could get, these things would measure an angle every few minutes, and you calculate the angle, so you could navigate the boat. And so we're going along, we're making this trip, and Don Rosenkrantz yelled out to me, "We're getting near it. I think we're near it." And all of a sudden, on the sonar record, this thing came up that was clearly a shipwreck. It wasn't a perfect outline, but I mean, there's no question. And so that became the first find of an ancient ship.
Wow.
With the sonar. So pretty dramatic stuff.
That's amazing. Yeah, I worked with Dr. Ballard on two expeditions, and they were off the coast of Greece, and that's exactly what we were doing, looking at ancient shipwrecks.
Yes.
So you guys were the led the way for us
really
in a lot
did.
Of ways.
Yeah. So it's funny, I came home, and when I got home, you know, in those days, long before cell phones or email, or in fact, if you wanted to make a call, you had to go to the post office in a little town, and you had to book a long-distance call for the next day, and you'd get on the line, and you could make a quick call. So we weren't in touch. It might not be till you got home that you learned what was going on. And I got home, and I met this fellow, Bob Henderson, who worked at EG&G, and I told him we had found this ancient ship. And he said, "Well, we just came back from England. We found the Mary Rose." So in that 1 year, it was an extraordinary year for for this technology to come about, and I was really honored to be quite a part of it.
I'd like to take a moment now to thank our sponsor for today's episode, Klein Marine Systems. Klein Marine Systems continues to develop new products and technologies for the unmanned vehicle market. Their latest release is the Micromax Nader Imaging System, which easily integrates into most AUV and ROV vehicles. When paired with a side scan system, the Micromax functions as a gap filler, providing a 40% increase in survey efficiency. The high resolution image performance provides the same interpretation characteristics as that of the side scan and is compatible with existing ATR systems. Now, you also, I know you've gone on so many expeditions, but you also were in Scotland on Loch Ness, correct?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that expedition and what that was like?
I can, certainly. Let me just interject a few sentences. I was working at what then was becoming a big bureaucratic company, and I wasn't getting really a lot of support or a lot of funding. So in 1968, I actually went off on my own and started my own company. It's a whole long story, but working in my basement in Lexington, a little rented cottage in Lexington, Mass., I started a little company. And one of the people who helped me with the company was a Boston lawyer, a man named Robert Rhines. He was a patent attorney. His father had been a patent attorney. And he was a very wealthy guy. He was an attorney for some of the early high-tech companies in the Boston area. And he was fascinated with Loch Ness. He just was, there are people who get, you know, obsessed with a certain shipwreck or a certain treasure ship or a certain whatever. He was obsessed. He wanted to find the Loch Ness Monster. So he invited me to go to Scotland with him and help with an expedition to find the monster. And I was dubious. I'm a scientist, and I was dubious. I had read a lot of the stories, and I was dubious, but I thought, I can bring my sonar. I've also learned that by that time that any body of water has things to find, not necessarily monsters, but there are living, there are fish and marine life, but there's also geology, there's also maybe things on the bottom. And so I went to Loch Ness, and one of the things, people had brought sonars there, and they had seen blobs on their sonars. And I devised a setup where, and you couldn't tell from these blobs if the ship was moving or the target was moving. So one of the things I did is fix the sonar at the shore, so it was on a tripod and it was perfectly still. And I actually saw some targets go by. I still to this day don't know what they were or exactly how big they were. Were they logs? Were they algae? Were they? There is stuff that floats in any body of water, including clumps of algae, which are pretty good sonar targets. But
right.
But then I did other survey work in the lock. I went there a lot of times over the years, and we didn't ever find the monster. It's it's not so easy, especially because it's probably not there. But I got involved in that culture, which was fascinating, because if you do monster hunting, you're lumped in with Bigfoot hunters and UFO hunters. And so a little bit weird getting involved in that whole world. There's so-called world of cryptozoology, where people look for unknown things. But I was involved with it a lot. And over the years, we found things in Loch Ness. We found some shipwrecks. As you say, we found some geology. We found some odd stone circle formations. And one of the things we found, totally by accident, I went with one of my colleagues, a guy named Charlie Finkelstein, and we were working long days at Loch Ness. And in those days, you made the records on a paper chart recorder. And so it wasn't until we got home where Charlie and I are looking over the records, and we see a shape that looks like a twin-engine aircraft.
Mm.
So Charlie called some friends at Loch Ness, and they told us that plane went down in the lock. And I went a couple of years later with some other guys. Well, one was Gary Kozak, who you may know, and Tom Cummings. And we made a better picture. And it turns out Tom Cummings was an old airplane buff. And he looked at the picture and he said, "That looks like a Wellington." I was flabbergasted. I didn't know what a Wellington, I don't know anything about the whole thing, but he did. And so we gave the record and the location to Harriet Watt University. It's in Edinburgh, and a man named Robin Holmes. And they came with an ROV, and they dove on the plane, and they determined it really was an old Wellington bomber that had ditched in World War II, and I think 1942. And this whole thing, expedition came. They actually came with Oceaneering, and they raised it.
Wow.
And they brought it to a museum in a place called Weybridge, that's about an hour south of London, a place called Brooklands. That's where the Wellingtons were built. So the plane was brought to this museum, and it's there. It, over the years, it got restored. For a while, there was the Loch Ness Wellington Association, and I was an honorary member, and I would go to England and have dinner with them. And I met some of the people who had built the plane, people who had flown in it, and I met these amazing old characters. And they came with their tools to the museum and started restoring it. And it's now, it's on display. I haven't been there for a long time, but they restored it, and it's just an amazing story. And actually, there's a timely thing going on. I've recently, it's some anniversary of the ditching of the plane, and these people have tracked me down who were involved in that project. They're going to make a memorial to the plane. And I've met this new set of people who were involved with the aircraft. One of them, his father, was one of the pilots.
Wow.
And they're in the process of making some memorials to be placed at Loch Ness, and I've gotten involved with them. I've been talking with them, and I'm hoping later this year to actually go and visit the plane and be there when they put this plaque up.
Yeah, you found that in 1976, right?
1976 and 78. The first find was 76, and the better picture we made in 78.
Got it.
I do want to comment, since we're talking about Loch Ness, people ask still to this day, you know, do you believe in it? And the fact is I don't. I could talk a lot about it, but what I do tell people, which is very much true, is there are creatures in the ocean, in lakes, in the deep sea, and you know, for example, nautilus, they're constantly finding new creatures, mm-hmm. deep, shallow, every imaginable shape and color and means of propulsion. So it's important to keep an open mind. There may be things in Loch Ness. They're probably not monsters, so-called, but there are still things to be found anywhere there's a body of water, including marine creatures, including pieces of history, including maybe old civilizations. So I say I sort of live in these different worlds. These monster hunters are a little bit weird, but there really are many things to find in the deep sea. And so it's great that there's a whole new generation of people going out with Ballard and going out on the Okeanos Explorer and some of these other ships that really are finding amazing things.
It is actually really interesting to me in the... I mean, you've had such an amazing career, Marty. You really have. I always love talking to you and listening to you because you've done so many different things. You've been on so many different projects and, you know, you're at the forefront of the marine technology industry. I mean, we're fortunate. I mean, you and I both live in Massachusetts and we're so fortunate that we have such a rich bed of marine technology and marine technology companies and, you know, people like you who started that. I'm wondering, one of the things as I'm listening to you, you've been on so many cool projects and expeditions. Is there any one or two expeditions that stand out to you for whatever reason?
Wow, tough one.
Maybe something, you know, we all have those sea stories from being out, you know, it's a very different environment that I think the layperson doesn't really understand. Yeah. To be out at sea, you know, for extended periods of time, what that's like. But I mean, anything really kind of different or sort of things that you can think of from projects that were kind of like, you know, made you pause or.
Yes. Well, one of them is the Alvin. I was a friend of Al Vine's, who the Alvin was named after. He was a Woods Hole scientist. And I was there when they launched the Alvin. I still have my pictures of the original Alvin, and I got to dive in it with a group from Woods Hole in the Bahamas down about 5,000 feet. And at the time, I had the side scan with me, but on the Alvin, I hooked up the thing as a downward-looking, as a mud penetrator. And I went down and made what was really the first sub-bottom profile made from a submersible in the Alvin.
Wow.
And diving in these things is amazing. One funny thing is everyone in this field is, I swear they're all 6'5". And I'm tiny. I'm a tiny little guy. I kind of fit in these submarines. And so I can tuck myself in a corner somewhere and not take up too much room. But operating in these subs is just amazing. And at one point in the sub, they had a depth device of some sort, and it didn't work. And all of a sudden, I was the altitude meter of the sub. And it's just a sobering thing. They turn to you and say, well, you're it. And so I'm holding my breath. Is everything going to keep working? And which it did. So that was, and I got to meet the crew of the Alvin. And a lot of these guys, I'm sure you've been around divers and these kind of people. A lot of them are wild, crazy guys, but they, when they have to do something, they do it. They just go into action. And it was really wonderful working with them back in those days. So the Alvin was one of my fun, memorable things.
Oh yeah. It's funny you mentioned the Alvin because it's my wallpaper on my laptop. And I've dove in a submersible. I dove in a Ocean Gate submersible, and that was a pretty amazing experience. And that was, you know, a shallow dive. I can't imagine being that deep in the Alvin. That must be pretty intense. Although I don't know that I could take being in that. The thing that people don't understand when you're doing that deep sea exploration, whether it's ROVs or manned submersibles, It takes so long to get there.
Yeah.
You know, it takes hours to get there. And I don't know that I could be cooped up like that for that length of time. So that I don't know how they do. And you and I have been divers forever. So we know that we're all us divers, we're all crazy. But I don't think I would, I think I would be kind of a little bit, okay, got to go kind of thing. Because even the dive I did in Ocean Gates, and, you know, it wasn't that long, but I did get a little claustrophobic, and I'm not claustrophobic at all. I mean, I've had students, I teach scuba diving, and I've had students that have said they were claustrophobic, and I thought, what's claustrophobic about diving? Trying to think of the mask, but I got into that sub, and I was like, okay, it's tight, and to be tight for that length of time is, I can imagine, pretty uncomfortable.
And you can't just step outside.
No, exactly. It definitely, I think it's definitely a certain breed of us that go out to sea in any capacity, because you really have to, you have to be, I don't want to say brave. I don't think it's that, but I think that you can't spook easily, and you really have to have your wits about you, because being out and working on the ocean, in it, on it, under it, can be a dangerous thing. And I don't think the average person realizes that.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And also the stakes, you know, you work on these ships that run around the clock. And I've had times, you know, this equipment, I try to make reliable equipment, but sometimes something would fail. And it would fail in the middle of the night. It would fail at 3 in the morning. And you might be sleeping, and they'd come rouse you up. I had some wonderful experiences over the years that were, here I am on the deck of a ship off the coast of Australia on this rolling ship in the middle of the night. I'm barely awake. I feel seasick. And there's this crowd of people standing around me with colorful language, which I guess we're on tape, so I won't use. But they're saying, You design this thing, you know, you fix it. And you're all alone, and you don't, you know, well somehow something happened, you know, you go into gear and you stay calm and you fix it. Not always, but a lot of times. Actually, I'd like, if you don't mind, I'd like to tell a side story about
Absolutely.
That. I was very blessed in my career to work with some amazing people. And one of my favorite people was a guy named Fred Squires, who he had been in the Navy in World War II. He was a tin can sailor. He worked on a destroyer in World War II. He had something like an eighth grade education. And when the war started, he just went in the war in the Navy. And he became, later on in life, he worked for Northeast Airlines. He drove. He delivered cars and trucks. He did all kinds of things. But he was just one of these people. He could build anything and do anything. And he was kind of unstoppable. He was just an amazing man. I used to travel with him. In the early days, we couldn't afford to ship our equipment and ourselves to the Offshore Technology Conference. And so Fred and I used to drive in my old station wagon, my old Pontiac. We would drive to the show, and so this guy was just amazing. He could build anything, he could fix anything. And for some of these most of these expeditions, I was alone. I was just me, but I'd take spares. I would take a kit of spares, and Fred used to pack my spares kit. And I still talk about it to this day. I had a number of occasions something would go wrong with the equipment, and I'd go to the spares kit, I'd open it up, and there at the top of the box was what I needed. Fred had this uncanny ability to anticipate what might go wrong and to pack it for me. And it was miraculous. And anyway, I was very blessed to work. He passed away, unfortunately, about a year ago. He was 90. I thought he was going to live forever. But it was a tremendous loss to lose him, but just
well,
amazing
he's somewhere else now packing the gearboxes.
and he's putting a new engine in it. He used to buy state police cars, Fords, and he would always drive Fords, and so he may be putting a new engine in one of his cars.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, it definitely takes a certain type of person to do things on the ocean, for sure. I think it's interesting. I've met some fascinating people, including yourself, and I consider myself really lucky to have the career that I've had too, and just can't imagine doing anything else, really. It's you know, the ocean technology and diving and marine technology has always been a passion of mine, so I feel very fortunate.
That's wonderful, yeah. I'm a big fan of yours, Rhonda.
Oh, Marty, you know I love you.
Thank you.
So, Marty, you started your company, originally Klein, and it was bought, right, by L3?
Yes, I ran it for a long time, 20-something years, and it was hard. Running a small business is hard, and, you know, we're in the middle of a weird time right now. There were weird times. Things would happen, and my forte, I was maybe a fairly good engineer at one time, but I became a business guy. So I'm meeting, my days are full of meetings with lawyers and bankers and insurance people and a lot of other stuff. And I actually lost some of the engineering edge, which is really, I really regretted. So at some point I decided I don't want to run this anymore. I love the field. I want to stay in it. And so I found a buyer for the company. It was actually a Japanese firm called Oyo. And since then it was bought, it's on its third owner. The Japanese sold it to a big military conglomerate called L3. And then finally, some years ago, about 4 years ago, a small company in Houston called Mitchum Industries bought it. And so they're the owners now.
Wow.
So I had various options. I thought about, you know, starting another new business. I really didn't want to. I also didn't want to compete with my old company. And I didn't want to compete with my friends like Bentos and EPC Labs and others. So I kind of retired. I've been retired. And we joke about it because I'm still busy all the time. But I just do things for MIT, for MAIT, for Sea Grant, for the MIT Museum. I keep busy and I keep in the field a little bit. But I also miss being really in the middle of it, knowing, you know, I get my information through publications and stuff. So I do miss being completely in the thick of it. But my old company is still going. We had a 50th anniversary a couple of years ago, and I'm in touch with them.
Oh, that's good. And you're still also taking care of your bonsai trees.
I am. I have various hobbies. I do model railroading. I do bonsai trees. I do photography. I've always had a lot of hobbies. But bonsai is a whole different thing. It's a very, very different than any technical thing. It's a hobby that teaches you humility every day. It's very, very challenging, and especially here in New England where it's cold, to keep these things alive.
Oh, I can imagine.
And so, but I love it. And it has a set of people just like the ocean world. There's a collection of odd people who are involved with it. And they may be from all walks of life. They may be a fireman, a policeman, a teacher, an accountant, whatever. And so the people in it are just in it because they love it. And so it's got its own charm.
That's great. Well, I'm glad you're keeping busy. Hopefully, we'll be able to connect at Oceanology or one of the other shows next year.
Yes, I hope so.
Well, Marty, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today. And it's always such a pleasure to talk with you. I'm looking forward to being able to see you in person, you know, hopefully at one of these conferences coming up. I was sad that MAIT, you know, we had to cancel MAIT this year. But
Yeah. I love the MAIT program and Jill and all the people. Yeah, that's really hard. And yesterday was the Mass State Science Fair, which I've been judging forever. And that was, we did it by virtual. Yeah. Not quite the same.
Well, you know, I honestly think that things are going to be, we're not going to go back to normal. There'll be a new normal, but we're not going to go back to normal.
Yeah.
And I think that in some ways that's okay.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, we're seeing the environment heal.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Hopefully there'll be some good.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. So, but we'll be chatting again soon, I'm sure, over Something diver or ocean related, I'm sure.
All right. You're right. You're on.
All right, okay. Marty. Well, stay safe and healthy, and thank you again so much.
You too. Take care, Rhonda.
Sea State with Rhonda Moniz is a production of the Technology Systems Corporation and the Underwater Investigative Group. For more information, visit oceannews.com and theuigroup.net. And before we leave today's podcast episode, I would like to thank our sponsors, Klein Marine Systems. So don't forget, visit their website at www.kleinmarinesystems.com or call 603-893-6131 to learn more about their complete product line. To stay up to date on Sea State, please subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Once again, I want to thank you for listening, and we will see you on the next Sea State.